Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The Burke Lectureship honors the memory of the late Gene Burke, an extraordinary Paulist priest who served in campus ministry at UCSD after a distinguished career as professor of theology at Catholic University of America and a visiting faculty member at Princeton and Columbia Universities. He was an advisor to the United Nations Human Rights Commission in drawing up the Declaration of Human Rights. He was a force for enlightenment in many areas, including his support for women's rights and establishing institutions to promote dialogue among people of different faiths. The Burke Lectureship at UCSD brings to this campus distinguished men and women who come from a wide range of backgrounds and whose work engages deeply with issues of religion and society. We have sponsored or co-sponsored speakers from the Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Islamic, Confucian, and Native American traditions. So it is my great pleasure now to introduce tonight's speaker, Ronald White. He was born in Minneapolis, grew up in Salinas and Glendale. He was educated at Northwestern University and UCLA, receiving his BA with honors in 1961. He received his MDiv from Princeton Theological Seminary in 1964, and his PhD from Princeton University in 1972. He studied at Lincoln Theological College in England and as a World Council of Churches scholar. Now, this got me to thinking, you wonder what the link is here. He went to studied at a college named Lincoln in a town called Lincoln. Now, of course, the college and the town were not named after the Lincoln we're going to be hearing about tonight. And the theological college predates the Lincoln we're talking about by a century or two. But maybe the name stuck in his mind, and when searching for an interesting intellectual topic, he saw Lincoln and thought, ah, this is it. Anyway, he taught at UCLA, Princeton Theological Seminary, Whitworth University, Colorado College, Fuller Seminary, and Rider University. He was dean and professor of American religious history at San Francisco Theological Seminary and is now emeritus. He is currently a fellow at the Huntington Library in San Marino and a visiting professor of history at UCLA. He's given many hundreds of lectures at civic clubs, universities, churches, and other venues. Professor White has lectured at the White House and has chosen to speak on Lincoln's religious thought to an audience of members of Congress and their spouses as part of the prelude to the bicentennial in February, sponsored by the Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. I want to add that while we have advertised Professor White to you as an eminent scholar of Abraham Lincoln, he was also an eminent scholar of what happened to race relations in the aftermath of the Civil War, such as Reconstruction. In an earlier book titled Liberty and Justice for All, Racial Reform and the Social Gospel, published in 1990, as a famous Civil War historian James McPherson put it in the preface to that book, previously, scholars had thought that the social gospel of progressive Christianity from the late 19th to early 20th centuries said nothing with real meaning about racial injustice and did little to help the cause of emancipation of the black American. But with White's important and path-breaking book, we can see the connections of progressive Christianity to racial reform in that era reaching to today. So White's career moved forward, but his subject matter moved backwards in history to Abraham Lincoln, who in many ways caused the post-Civil War Reconstruction and civil reform that White had studied earlier in his career. In a 2002 book titled Lincoln's Greatest Speech, The Second Inaugural, was honored as a New York Times Notable Book of 2002 and was on Washington Post and San Francisco Chronicle bestseller list. This speech, Lincoln's Greatest Speech, is known as one of the most unusual inaugural speeches and well deserves study. In 2005, he published The Eloquent President, A Portrait of Lincoln Through His Words. McPherson again wrote of this book that all those who are interested in American political history as well as the Civil War will find this book indispensable. In The Eloquent President, White examines Lincoln's oratory and explores his growth as a leader, communicator, and man of deepening spiritual conviction, which we'll hear a bit about tonight. His most recent book is the just published A. Lincoln, A Biography, which has been on the New York Times and Washington Post bestseller lists. It's been described as one of the best Lincoln biographies in many years, and that one of its strengths is its analysis of Lincoln's developing religious convictions. Professor White has published op-eds describing the connection between Lincoln and our current president, Barack Obama. As he may well share with you tonight, Obama's decision to select the same Bible for his inauguration that Abraham Lincoln used at the first inauguration in 1861 forges an intriguing connection between the two presidents. He also announced, Obama that is, his run for the White House on the steps of the old state capitol in Springfield, Illinois, where Lincoln gave his House Divided speech. Lincoln faced, and Obama is facing, times of trouble for the nation. And I'm looking forward to understanding more about Lincoln's religious journey, not only out of historical interest, but perhaps as getting a window of insight into our current events. So without further ado, I'd like you to join me in welcoming our speaker, Ronald White.
Thank you for that generous, thoughtful introduction. It's an honor to be part of this distinguished lecture series. When I first heard about it, I mistakenly thought this was at the University of San Diego. And then I've learned of the role of this person in this great university. In the fall of this past year, I taught a course at UCLA called A History of Religion in the United States. And I told my students at the beginning of the class, I said, now there's an elephant here at UCLA. I said, we all know it's here, but we've kind of conspired not to talk about it. I said, do you know what that is? Well, we wouldn't want to break the barrier between church and state. That would be unthinkable. We wouldn't want to risk proselytizing each other. I said, so we don't talk very much about religion and society here. I said, let me ask you a question. Who is Martin Luther King? And I asked the students this question, and they came back with the answer, civil rights reformer, on and on and on. Not one person mentioned that he was a black Baptist minister, which is the foundation of who he is. So I said, well, let me try another one. And we went on and on and on. By the end of the semester, the students came up to me and said, for goodness sakes, I never really realized in the classes that I'm taking, I'm sorry if I'm offending any faculty who are here, that religion is so central to the story of American history. One of the persons I tried was Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln has been viewed, the most recent poll ranks him at the top of the list. I was asked at a dinner this evening if I would do that. It's hard to rank people. Barack Obama, I suppose, is the one who's brought the greatest attention to Lincoln. This is in 2009, this is the bicentennial of Abraham Lincoln's birth. I've been privileged to travel all over this country since January. I cannot believe the celebrations that are taking place, from eighth graders writing essays on Lincoln in Vermont in the shadow of Robert Todd Lincoln's home, to Tuesday night being in Quincy, Illinois, as they step forward to celebrate the sixth Lincoln-Douglas debate. But even more than that, last Thursday evening I was speaking at the John F. Kennedy Institute at the Free University in Berlin. And after the lecture was over, I sat next to a German graduate student who said to me, in obviously a second language, he said, you know, he said, Lincoln's farewell address at Springfield must be the most marvelous address there is in English. And then he said it to me completely from memory. The week before, I was in Italy, and in Rome, I just couldn't believe the fascination, and I sort of asked the question, why? Why is this great interest of Lincoln all over the world this year? And one person came back to me and said, well, Washington, Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, they are well-born, benefit of great education. Lincoln, to us, seems to represent what America must be about. Lincoln called it the right to rise. That Lincoln begins with nothing, with less than 1 year of formal education, and yet he rises by the dint of his character, by his self-education. But the interesting part of Lincoln I want to talk about tonight is his religious journey. I love Barack Obama's great book, The Audacity of Hope. And in that book, people have looked very carefully at Barack Obama, but almost like Lincoln, they haven't looked at Obama's chapter on faith, which is a remarkable chapter. And I believe Obama's modeling himself after Lincoln is in a whole variety of ways, but I think Obama also, we'll say more about this tomorrow perhaps, Obama's also modeling himself in terms of Lincoln's inclusive religious spirit. I think this is what this lecture series is all about, and the man whom we honor in it is all about, this inclusive religious spirit. But that's not always the Lincoln that is presented to us. And somehow when we encounter him, we need to see perhaps a different window on who he is. When I begin to think of Lincoln, I begin and end at the Lincoln Memorial. How many of you have been to the Lincoln Memorial? Many people. Maybe it was when you were a school child that you first went to the Lincoln Memorial, or perhaps it was more recently. You'll recall that when you walk up to that memorial, you walk up those steps, the Park Service rangers say it's the second most visited place in Washington, second only to the Vietnam Memorial. Maybe in 2009 it's the most visited place. When you walk up the steps, you first encounter that tall Daniel Chester French statue, 29 feet high, and then you walk into what I call that temple space. On the left, carved on one panel, is the Gettysburg Address. Most people are looking to the left. If you look to the right, on three panels, carved in Indiana limestone, is the second inaugural address. Would several of you just be willing to give voice to the feeling or the experience that you had at that time? What was it like for you? Anyone? Yes. What she's saying is this wonderful poem about Nancy Hanks, suggesting the incredibly humble origins of Lincoln comes, and Nancy Hanks, who died when Lincoln was 9, and what she might have thought that this was her son. How did he come to be this way? You ask me if I can answer that question. I'm not sure I can, but we'll work on it together tonight. Someone else just give their experience or feeling of standing there in that space, maybe looking at the Gettysburg Address, the second inaugural address. Anyone? It was emotional. It is not just another memorial. I've had so many people describe their experience there. There's a lot of great memorials in Washington. This is not just another memorial. There's a sense of inspiration. I've heard people say awe, or younger people have said awesome. The reason that I've written my biography, though, is this conviction, that awe is not the same thing as understanding. When I was a student at UCLA, I sang in the a cappella choir that was led by the legendary Roger Wagner, founder of the Roger Wagner Chorale. Our junior year, we sang Bach's St. John's Passion. At the end of that, the impresario that he was, he told us next year we would sing something a little more difficult. We would sing Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. But it dawned on me, as much as I was gripped by the experience, I think we were almost all in tears, I didn't really understand the music. So my senior year, I took courses for non-music majors, one on Bach and one on Beethoven. I've really written my biography for non-Lincoln majors. I believe that every generation needs to encounter Lincoln afresh, that young people today are coming with some tough questions for Lincoln. Was Lincoln a racist? What was his real motivation in putting in place the Emancipation Proclamation? I also believe, as one who teaches history, that we often see something like the Lincoln-Douglas debates or the Gettysburg Address or the second inaugural as an event, but have we really taken the time to explore it? That's what we're going to do this evening. This is my attempt, in the spirit of this series, to talk about what I think is the most profound address in American history, certainly dealing with the intersection of religion and politics. For I would argue that in America we have separated church and state. We have never separated religion and politics. Some of us may think that we haven't done a very good job of putting them together in recent years. That doesn't mean it can't be done. I think Lincoln is a fascinating exhibit of how it might be done. I've given you the text in your hand. Lincoln writes his second inaugural address. It's the second shortest inaugural address ever offered. The shortest, George Washington. He didn't want to run, certainly not for a second term. There was no tradition, and so I like to say that when Washington delivered his second inaugural address, he said, in effect, "Thank you very much," in 135 words. Well, we know that inaugural addresses are not 135 words. Don't tell Bill Clinton that. We've got to get going with something much longer. But Lincoln offers a 701 words. But in those 701 words, he mentions God 14 times, quotes the Bible 4 times, and invokes prayer 3 times. Now, the point isn't to count up how many times he does this or that or the other, but to ask the question, what is its meaning? Now, when I entered into the study of Lincoln not many years ago, my academic colleague said, well, don't get too excited about these religious references. That's what politicians do. We know that today. That's what politicians do in a largely religious nation. So I decided to read the previous 18 inaugural addresses, and sure enough, every single one of them mentions God and with various names for God, but always in the last paragraph, almost like kind of a, and we need God's help too. That's not what Lincoln is doing here. And then I was told that, of course, all inaugural addresses would quote Scripture, and this has become a pattern of recent inaugural addresses. But you might be surprised, I was, to discover in those 18 inaugural addresses before Lincoln, the Bible was quoted only one time. It was never quoted. John Quincy Adams quoted it from the Psalms, "Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain." So here we have the enigma. Lincoln, perhaps the only president who never joined a church, the one who many said then and now is certainly not religious, and yet he offers this profound engagement of religion and politics. Let's look at the text and see if we can discover what he's doing. He begins at this second appearing to take the oath of the presidential office. There is less occasion for an extended address than there was at the first. This is not exactly 67 years ago. We need to step back for a moment and get a sense for the context. 25 to 35,000 people have arrived on March 4, 1865. This terrible war has gone on and on and on. 620,000 dead, as many as all of our other wars put together. If we would make an equivalent of that tiny nation, 30 to 40 million people, compared to the size of our nation today, even as many of us struggle with the casualties in Iraq, it would be as if there were 5 million casualties in Iraq. When I spoke in the little town of Manchester, Vermont, in January, and the eighth graders read their essays on Lincoln, I was told that the folks at the Robert Todd Lincoln Home had done some studies on who were these Union soldiers that left Manchester to fight in the Civil War. And they discovered that 37 left their town to fight, and six returned alive. This is what it did to this nation. We were talking at dinner about the wonder of Barack Obama's inauguration, and some who have the great joy and privilege of being there, and the celebration of it. I expected that would be what would have been surrounding Lincoln's second inaugural, and I was quite surprised by what I found. I read the diaries and the letters of people who were there, and I found a very different feeling. Those letters contained deep sentiments of anger. People were deeply angry that day. Why were they angry? Because probably every person present had lost a father, husband, son, brother, and they were angry about the South, and they wanted Lincoln to give voice to their anger. That's what we do in war. We demonize the enemy. We don't teach German in the first decades of the 20th century because we demonize them. We demonize the Japanese. We demonize whoever happens to be the opponent. And so certainly Lincoln would rise to this. Well, in that day, unlike ours, the parade was before the inauguration. And one of the floats in the parade was printing a little newspaper on its press and tossing it out to the people. And this particular paper said, this is the day for Lincoln, in a sense, to crow a bit. He's been criticized all these 4 years. What you do in inaugural addresses, they're really often exercises of self-congratulation. Aren't we a wonderful country? And aren't I a wonderful candidate? And so this press said Lincoln ought to crow a bit about all of his accomplishments. What would Lincoln say? Would he demonize the South? Would he crow a bit? Let's see. The first paragraph is Lincoln breaks every single rule of modern leadership studies. Instead of sort of saying all the wonderful things I've done, I think of how many times we were told there were turning points in the war of Iraq. You couldn't even keep track of how many turning points there were in the war of Iraq. Lincoln decides to diminish our expectations rather than increase them. Watch the way he does it. Line two, there is less occasion for an extended address than there was at the first. Line eight, little that is new could be presented. The second line from the end of the first paragraph, no prediction in regard to it is ventured. What a strange way to begin an inaugural address. When we come to the second paragraph, we begin to get a sense of the rhetorical strategy of Lincoln, what he's about. Lincoln is asking himself a question. It's very important what questions we ask. He's asking a question that almost no one is asking. His question is, how can the South be brought back into the Union without being alone to bear the blame and the shame? And his answer to that question is his marvelous use of what I call inclusive language. He imputes the best possible motivation to the South. Watch the way he does this. On the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it. All sought to avert it. At the end of the paragraph, towards the end, both parties deprecated war. The first time I ever talked about this was at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, and a Princeton University PhD English professor immediately challenged me and said, but don't you see that at the end of that second paragraph, he's really saying, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. Isn't he blaming the South? Yes, but when we listen to professors or preachers or politicians, pay attention to what they don't say as well as what they do say. If Lincoln would have said what he could have said, but those traitors, those Confederates, that enemy, oh, the crowd would have risen in applause. They would have cheered him on. But Lincoln decides to use the very innocuous word, but one of them would make war. Very self-consciously, I believe, intentionally lowering the decibels of his speech. Now, in the second paragraph, we begin to get something. This has nothing to do with religion, but I have to talk about it anyway. We get something of the wonderful rhetorical artistry of Lincoln. This kind of gets to your question. How in the world could he do this? Is it nature or nurture? He has three or four rhetorical devices. One is alliteration. Now, this is an extra credit question. Who can tell us what is alliteration? I asked this question once in Phoenix, Arizona, and there were two 13-year-old girls sitting in the front row, and I think they'd just been studying this in the eighth grade, and the one girl leaped out of her seat to give the right answer. It's the use of the same consonants over and over again. Lincoln loved alliteration. On the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it. All sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place, devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, insurgent agents were in the city seeking to destroy it without war, seeking to dissolve the Union and divide effects by negotiation. Both parties deprecated war. Eight times in these several sentences, Lincoln uses the consonant D. Now, what does alliteration do for you and me, the listener, especially the listener on that day in a cold, windy day outside in the first days of March in Washington, D.C., struggling to hear this man without obviously any amplification? What does alliteration do as we listen? Anyone? It provides a kind of device of memory. There's a kind of invisible symmetry, it's unconscious perhaps, that brings it together. It's almost like in music, a crescendo. It builds and builds and builds. And just as I was saying this, the other 13-year-old girl leaped out of her seat. And she said to me, interrupted me, and said, do you mean to tell me that Abraham Lincoln decided to use the consonant D eight times in the second paragraph? I said, no. He had a sense for the sound of words. He always read out loud, to the consternation of his law partner, Willie Herndon. I learned that school children always read out loud in American public education until the 1920s or 1930s, till some teacher got the bright idea, shh, Johnny, you're disturbing Mary, read to yourself. Lincoln said he read out loud so he could get the two senses, the sense of the eye and the sense of the ear, and he had this wonderful sense of alliteration. Later he will say, fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray. Another rhetorical device that Lincoln uses, and he uses it especially in the Gettysburg Address where he can only speak 272 words. Can you imagine Edward Everett had spoken for 2 hours and 7 minutes, and then Lincoln gets up and speaks for 2.5 minutes? What's the word that Lincoln keeps repeating in the second paragraph? Over and over and over again he uses this word. It's a noun. It's the word war. 7 times as a noun, 2 times as a pronoun. Well, this is what everybody is thinking about. This is what's on their mind. And Lincoln is standing almost outside of the events here. It's like he's a chronicler. In the Gettysburg Address, he uses not one personal pronoun, not one. Can you imagine a modern politician speaking without saying, I? And in the second inaugural, he uses but 2 personal pronouns. In fact, he has a very tortured syntax, if you notice that in the third line, while the inaugural address was being delivered from this place. Why didn't he simply say why I delivered the inaugural address? Once a group of soldiers from Ohio came to visit him, and he said to them, you know, this is the most wonderful country in which we live. Any of your children could one day become president of the United States, just like my father's child has. Just like my father's child has. Abraham Lincoln. Well, the use of war is a direct object, both grammatically and historically. It's the action of the soldiers, the generals, Lincoln as commander-in-chief. And then, like Bach's St. John's Passion, which goes along on one major key to the final chorale where it switches to a minor key, Lincoln's final sentence is absolutely astounding in the second paragraph. 4 syllables, 4 words. In fact, of the 701 words in this address, 505 are 1 syllable. Lincoln loved he didn't call it the King James Bible, he called it the Saxon Bible, the strong, sturdy Saxon language of the English Bible. And I wondered for the longest time how Lincoln might have said these words. I think Edward Everett, who was the epitome of the high-toned orator of the 19th century, might have said something like, "And the war came." But how do you think Lincoln might have said those words at the end of the second paragraph? Sadly, slowly, mournfully. And he does something absolutely remarkable. The war in that final sentence is no longer the direct object. It's the subject. Lincoln has discovered something that we Americans seem to have a very difficult time in discovering, that when you start a war, you will not be in control of that war. That war will end up being in control of you. When I spoke that day at the Air Force Academy, my guide was a United States Marine, a PhD, chaplain in one engagement in Vietnam, wounded 38 times. And when we left the Air Force Academy, he said, "Ron, there is a war that's coming. And the generals will say, and the people at this academy will say, because we are the greatest military machine in the world, we will be in charge of this war." He said, "Do not believe it. We will not be in charge of this war." And Lincoln knew that the North was in charge of this war. They all believed they would win it in 3 to 6 months. They had twice the size of the Army of the South. They had the industrial might. They had the population. Vietnam taught us the lesson that that doesn't necessarily mean you can win a war. And Lincoln watched this war spin out of control, and he was aghast that brother fought brother and that this civilized nation had become so torn by war. And he said, I think slowly and mournfully, "And the war came." The third paragraph, the longest paragraph, is a remarkable recapitulation of the meaning of the war. We have been taught, and it is true, that the war began to save the Union, But somehow the war changed, and Lincoln says this in this paragraph. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. The irony of Barack Obama is this, that 25 to 35 years ago, a particular African-American writer began to say Abraham Lincoln is a racist. And that message has been communicated to African-American children and school children throughout this land. I've encountered it over and over and over again. Abraham Lincoln is not our friend. I was teaching junior high school students in Bloomington, Illinois, and I was told I wanted to meet this one teacher who was the best eighth grade teacher in the school, and she said, help me, I'm caught in a terrible dilemma. We're team teaching this class. I'm teaching them of the wonder of Lincoln, and my cohort is teaching that Lincoln is nothing more than a racist. And the irony of Barack Obama is that here is this African-American president, our first African-American president, who is looking to Lincoln to be his model. Well, that book on Lincoln the racist has nothing to say at all about the second inaugural address because, of course, it couldn't. Lincoln spends the whole third paragraph talking about the fact that slavery is the basis of this war. And then when you turn your page, he does something absolutely distinctive in inaugural addresses before or since when he begins to say, both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. Lincoln is now signaling that he's going to think and speak theologically as well as politically about the meaning of this war. And notice that he begins inclusively. Both read the same Bible. He's saying to the people of the North, the people of the South read the Bible every bit as much as you do. The Confederate soldiers read the Bible every bit as you do. A surprising research source for me, I hadn't expected this, was to travel to the headquarters of the American Bible Society in New York City. It's the only voluntary society established in the 19th century that still exists in the 21st century. And in their wonderful archive are all these Bibles carried by Southern and Northern soldiers. Of course, you couldn't carry a big Bible, so they had pocket Bibles. When the field at Gettysburg was cleared in preparation for the ceremony that would inaugurate the first military cemetery, 50,000 dead, wounded, and missing were on that battlefield. And it was decided to take everything off the clothing of the soldiers and file it so that relatives, wives, children, parents could come, pocket watches, diaries, letters, money. What they chiefly found were Bibles. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God. And then Lincoln does a semicolon. Please be careful of the internet. The internet, in its ultimate wisdom, has decided to modernize Lincoln's punctuation and absolutely messed up the meaning of his words. Because every time Lincoln uses a semicolon, which we don't use much today, he moves in a different direction and each invokes his aid against the other. That's an indictment. Lincoln has become so tired of delegations of ministers that have come to him to say, God is on our side, God is on our side. The equivalent of every single politician feeling the need to conclude every single political address with, God bless America, God bless America. Lincoln and you and I, if we're interested in religion and society, need to be concerned about the misuse of religion as well as the use of religion. Lincoln was very aware of the misuse of religion. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. As I tried to understand the meaning of this address, I wanted to find the antecedents. You can find the antecedents to most great addresses in America. You can find it for the Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. You can find it for Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. You can't find it for the second inaugural, except in two places. One of them was that 3 months to the day before the address, two women came to see Lincoln. Lincoln drove his secretaries crazy because he just was seeing people all the time. These two women were the wives of Confederate officers confined to a Union prison. They wanted to see Lincoln. Lincoln let them in. He called these visits his public opinion baths. his public opinion baths, what were ordinary people thinking? These women knew that Lincoln was a softy, that he, when women came and plied him with their words and especially their tears, that he would overturn the order of the general in terms of death for this young soldier who had fallen asleep as a sentry or who had failed to fight. Lincoln wrote about one particular man, "I think he will be better above ground than below ground." He went on to win the Medal of Honor. So these women came to Lincoln and said, "Our husbands are religious men." And Lincoln said, "Oh, well, let's talk about that." He invited the women to come back a second day. Were they surprised? He then invited them to come back for a third day. Were his secretaries surprised? And in that third day, he said to these two women, "I find it very difficult when you tell me that your husbands are religious men. How can religious men go against the duly authorized rule of this land? But more importantly," and then he quotes what I just read to you because he knew it from memory. This is Genesis 3:19. "It seems strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces." What is he saying? Your husbands are involved in slavery. And Lincoln, who knew the Bible, is really saying then and now, the Bible is not simply there and then, back there. It's a document of the past. It's here and now, and that's how he's going to apply it. With that, he dismisses these two women and says to them, "That's not the kind of religion that gets people to heaven." But Noah Brooks of the Sacramento Daily Union, who was to be his secretary in the second term, was sitting out in the hallway, and he calls Brooks in and he says, "I want to write down this interview with these two women. I kind of liked what I said to them. I think I'll use it someday." 3 months to the day, he uses it. But then comes a semicolon. I think Lincoln looked at his words. This is very harsh. "But let us judge not that we be not judged." Lincoln now quotes Jesus from the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7, verse 5. Reporters picked this up. They called this Lincoln's Sermon on the Mount. That was the title I wanted to call my book. But all authors know that you don't get to choose your own title. And so my editor said, "Oh, we don't want to do that." She said, "Here's the title of your book, Lincoln's Greatest Speech." She said, "That's sexier." I said, "Sexier?" Yeah, she said, "Everybody will think it's the Gettysburg Address." But this is really Lincoln's Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is all based on an ethic of Jesus that moves against law and offers charity, justice, forgiveness, reconciliation. This is what this speech is all about. "The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes." This is the central theological affirmation of this address. It's the central piece of the architecture of the address. It occurs right in the center of the address. The Almighty has his own purposes. Great literature has so many levels of meaning. At one level, Lincoln's often offering affirmation. The Almighty has his own purposes. But at another level, if you think about it, there's an inscrutability to these purposes. There's a humility on the part of the one who is affirming it. Lincoln is not in any way saying, "And I know exactly what those purposes are." There's a humility behind these words. And then the ultimate surprise of this address, there's never been an address like it before since Barack Obama tried to do this in January, and he moved in that direction to tell us that we got problems in this society. Jimmy Carter tried to do that, and he paid for it by losing the next election to a Ronald Reagan who said, "We don't have any problems in this society. This society can do anything. We don't want to hear that there are limits in our society." Abraham Lincoln tells us there are great limits. "Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh." He thunders from the Gospel of Matthew. My goodness, this sounds like a Puritan Jeremiad. This is what the Puritan preachers said in the second, third, and fourth generations. They said, "You have lost the faith of the founders. God has a complaint against you." What is the complaint? Lincoln tells us right away. if we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses. Now think again what Lincoln might have said and what the response of the audience might have been. If Lincoln simply would have said, if we shall suppose that slavery is one of those offenses, oh, the crowd would have cheered, because they would have assumed he was pointing the finger south of the Mason-Dixon line at Southern slavery. But when Lincoln says American slavery, he is saying we are all part of this problem. Lincoln inherited a judicial case where a slave owner and most of the slave ships sailed out of New England. This slave owner had been condemned to die by hanging. He was from Connecticut. His wife came twice to plea for her husband's life. Lincoln let the sentence stand, and the man died from hanging. American slavery. We're all part of this problem, which in the providence of God must needs come, but which having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and he gives to both North and South that inclusive spirit. This terrible war, as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern any departure therein from the divine attributes which the believers in the living God always ascribe to him? This is a moral universe. This is not what we want to hear in inaugural addresses, that there's a great evil in the middle of our American society. But Lincoln presents this evil almost as a Puritan Jeremiad. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge may speedily pass away. And then this amazingly picturesque language. Yet if God wills that it continue, until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk. You see, the 250 years stretches way back before the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. Until every drop of blood drawn with a lash, slavery, shall be paid by another drawn with a sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether, Psalm 19:9. Now, we're used to inaugural addresses where people applaud, 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 applaud. The reporter for the New York Herald said there were only four occasions of applause in the entire address. But the reporter for the Times of London, sometimes when you stand outside of one's culture, you see things more clearly. And this reporter was taken by how many people were at this inauguration who had never been to inauguration before. In a terrible day of wind and rain where people were dressed in pretty dour clothes, these people were dressed in reds and blues and yellows. They were there to celebrate. And although there were only four occasions of applause, he began to hear something. You might wonder, where did it begin? When did it begin in the address? It began in the back and began to come forward. Bless the Lord. 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 The African Americans took up the chant in the crowd. Bless the Lord. Bless the Lord. Frederick Douglass, the greatest African American of the 19th century, who had been deeply concerned by Lincoln's first inaugural, but had met Lincoln in 63 and 64, he came that day wondering what would be offered. He wrote in his diary that evening, this was not a state paper. This was a sermon. Well, people are still arriving. Lincoln's getting ready to conclude. And if it's a sermon, and it's not technically a sermon, the 19th century sermon would have been something like this. The first three-fourths of the sermon would have been what I would call the indicative. The indicative announced in the sermon is what God has done. What God has done in bringing the people of Israel through the Red Sea, what God has done in the life, teaching, death, resurrection of Jesus. Lincoln's indicative is the Almighty has his own purposes. But then and now, if you attend church, synagogue, whatever, you're probably expecting the minister or the priest at the end of the sermon to say, and now in the coming week we should. This is what Lincoln does in the last paragraph. Lincoln must have thought, this is the most deeply divided nation. We have never been torn apart like we are. What can I say at the end of this address? I want to suggest to you that we need to have an unvoiced therefore at the beginning of the last paragraph to catch what Lincoln is doing, because now he's offering the imperative. He's moved from the indicative, and he's saying, this is what we ought to do. And to fully appreciate what he's saying, I want us to say these words out loud together, because only when you hear these words do you catch the enormous power. At the celebration of, if that's the right word, the anniversary of 9/11, at the first year, the people of New York looked around to find who is the poet, who is the actor, who is the politician who can offer words for us to memorialize. They couldn't find one. They simply read the words of Abraham Lincoln. The remarkable thing is that we're studying all these people in this great university, as well we should, in literature, economics, politics, history, sociology, but somehow Lincoln's words transcend this time, and I think this last paragraph does so more than perhaps any other. Let's say these words together. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Gamblers in the street were betting that Abraham Lincoln would be inaugurated for a third term in 1869. And served to March 1873. But it was not to be. In 41 days, he would be dead. At 7:22 a.m., his death occurred, and through the telegraph, the word spread quickly throughout the nation. And already by the early afternoon hours of that Saturday, people gathered in small and large communities across the nation to memorialize, to eulogize the dead president. It was the day before Easter. In Rochester, New York, the mayor convened a meeting, and he asked three white men to give their eulogies for Abraham Lincoln. But slipping into the crowd in the back few rows was Frederick Douglass. And they noticed him, and the crowd turned and said, "Douglass, Douglass, Douglass." So Frederick Douglass stood up, and he said, from memory, the last six sentences of the second inaugural address. This had so struck him, and he said, these words will live on as long as the English language is spoken. When I wrote my book, I was invited to go to the American History Museum in Washington, and there's something called the attic up in the top, where they keep sort of the Holy of Holies, and they keep the things that are related to each of the presidents. And I was mightily intrigued to find there that they had a series of what were called mourning badges. People wore the badges at Lincoln's death throughout the city of Washington. And on that mourning badge, I found these words, with malice toward none, with charity for all. For ultimate Lincoln was not simply the words that he spoke, but how he embodied these words. Now, I've been asked the question, and I'm going to stop right now, but this might be part of our conversation and questions. I've been asked innumerable times on talk shows and lectures, Dr. White, you will have to admit that Abraham Lincoln was speaking in the middle of the 19th century to a largely Christian or Jewish Christian community. Do you really think it's possible to talk about religion in public speech today? And after a long pause, I say, yes. I said, it's not been done well, I admit that, but I said, I think Abraham Lincoln is our guide. Watch what he's doing in this address. He's doing so inclusively, with great respect for people of differing points of view. I've had Muslims, I've had Jews, I've had all kinds of people resonate and respond to this address. He does so with a sense of humility. The English press, who had savaged Lincoln during his presidency, they called him the village attorney. They responded more than the American press to the second inaugural, and one of them wrote, If this address had been written by any other American politician, it would have been arrogant or boastful. But delivered by Abraham Lincoln, it's almost if God has used the weak things of the world to shame the wise. There were only five newspapers still publishing in the South. One was at Petersburg, where Grant was besieging, and the editor of the Petersburg Daily Express was obviously not quite sure what to make of this, because Lincoln, you see, was the black Republican or the nigger lover in the South. That was the two favorite caricatures by which he was presented through the entire Civil War. So the editor, 5 days after the address, writes in his newspaper, "I'm not quite sure what to make of this. This man seems to be a leader of peace. He relies upon the Holy Scripture. Perhaps I will have to conclude as he concluded, let us judge not, that we be not judged." I offer this to you this evening because I think these words have something that are of great historical value in this Lincoln bicentennial, that Barack Obama has shined a bright light on Abraham Lincoln. But I invite you to take this home with you because I think these words can be discovered by each one of us as words that somehow transcend time, and that Lincoln in a remarkable way is our contemporary. Oh, he can't answer the questions of climate change. He can't advise Barack Obama on all these specific questions, but I think he offers a habit of mind, a humility of heart, and for those of us especially concerned on how religion and society can converge and come together and inform, Lincoln, I think, can be our guide. Thank you very much.
The first inaugural had William Seward make comments on it, and it's interesting the changes that Seward recommended and Lincoln accepted, I think some were adapted. Was there any influence by Seward or others in the writing of this? And specifically, do you know, were any changes made from what Lincoln had originally?
A good comment. Lincoln, I'm often asked, were these Lincoln speeches? We know of speech writers. And you correctly suggest that William Seward, to Lincoln's great surprise, gave Lincoln a letter 7 pages long, 49 suggestions on how he could improve his inaugural address, told him to forget the last paragraph. I've written 2 new ones. You can choose which one to use. Lincoln actually accepted 27 of the 49 with some modification. Seward helped him with his special address to Congress on July 4, 1861, but there's no evidence that he did so again. When Lincoln left Gettysburg, a woman came up to Seward and said, "I know you helped him with the first inaugural address. I bet you helped him with this one." He said, "Madam, only Abraham Lincoln could have written this address." There's only one conversation. Lincoln meets 2 men in his office 1 week before, and he said, "This is my inaugural address, and it's 600 words. Well, it ends up being 700. So I don't think by that time Lincoln was showing his addresses to others, but we don't know very much about the literary history of it. It's printed in 4 paragraphs. Lincoln, who I think in another career would have been an actor, had actually taken a scissors and paste, as it were, and divided it into 8 paragraphs and underlined all the words so that this kind of cued his dramatic reading of it.
Well, Mr. White, I've very much enjoyed your magnificent and eloquent lecture. My question to you is, in this time of enhanced interrogation techniques, many have looked back at Lincoln's lifting of the writ of habeas corpus as a parallel. And I wonder if in his journey of faith you learn any insights about how he dealt with that difficult topic.
Very good question. And his writ of habeas corpus, where he's suspending habeas corpus, has been attempted to be used by President Bush and his administration as a precedent. Lincoln was aware, and habeas corpus is a difficult doctrine, because where does it lodge, even in the Constitution? Does it lodge with Congress? Does it lodge with the president? That's a debatable issue. There's no particular connection that I've found with the sort of religion and society and that ruling. I think Lincoln was aware of what he was doing. He said at one time, "Am I to sort of not break this one rule and allow the whole nation to fall to pieces?" So he felt it was necessary, and he has been judged by that, criticized by it, sustained by others. Yeah. Let me ask you a question. Lincoln received a congratulatory letter on the second inaugural address. And the reason for the title, Lincoln's Greatest Speech, it does have some credence besides my editor, because he said in reply to this letter of congratulation, "I think it is my best effort." And I think it's much larger than the Gettysburg Address. I love the Gettysburg Address. The great-grandson of John Adams wrote to his father, who was the minister representing the United States in England, and he said, "Isn't this rail splitter a wonder? Once at Gettysburg, and now in the second inaugural, this will become," he told his father, the boy who wrote was in his 20s, "it will become the historical keynote of this war." But Lincoln writes back to his correspondent, "I think this is my best effort, but it's not immediately popular." Why do you think it was not immediately popular in Lincoln's point of view, Lincoln's eyes? It didn't condemn the South. It wasn't triumphalist about himself. Then Lincoln offered his own answer. "Men do not like to be told that their way is not God's way, but I thought it was a truth worth telling." Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.